Hello, I'm Robert Royal, and I'm the editor-in-chief of The Catholic Thing. I'd like to welcome you to this latest in our series of Catholic Thing podcasts. For those of you who don't already know us, The Catholic Thing is an online daily column series, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Our columns are short by design, under 1,000 words, so that while drinking a cup of coffee or in just a few minutes, you can get a brief but substantial commentary on faith and reason or the church and the world by some of the very best Catholic writers and thinkers. You can subscribe to The Catholic Thing. It's free by going to our website, www.thecatholicthing.org, all lowercase, and enter your email address. It's simple, and you'll receive the column every day in your inbox at 6 a.m. Give it a try. We're sure you'll be glad that you did.
So I'm very pleased that today we have with us Mary Eberstadt, who is a senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute and writes for The Catholic Thing and is a widely published author and speaker. I'm sure many of you who are watching today know who she is. And we thought that one of the interesting things that would be for our viewers early on in this series would be to talk with her about a book that's had quite an impact and has gotten pretty much everywhere in the world these days, and it's called Primal Scream. So Mary, welcome, and tell us a bit about this most recent of your books. Your books are eagerly waited for. I remember you sent me a note that a priest or a reader said he waits for your books like kids wait for each iteration of Harry Potter. So what is this strange title, Primal Screams, refer to?
So Primal Screams is the latest book in which I try to re-examine the true legacy of the sexual revolution. And in Primal Screams, I'm opening the aperture widely to ask, what is it doing to our politics? Because if you take a step back from the blogosphere and the internet, and you look at the phenomenon of identity politics, not only in the United States, but across the world, you see something remarkable, Bob, which is that a lot of people in this age are experiencing a crisis of identity. They are desperate to know who they are. And so instead of dismissing the phenomenon of identity politics, which it's often tempting to do, I wanted to take a closer look at it to see what is driving this crisis of the self. And my answer, perhaps unexpected, is that the old ways of establishing identity, by reference to one's family and one's role in the family, and by reference to one's religious faith, have become off limits for many people in our secularizing time. And this and this, I think, is what drives the panic behind identity politics and the desperate desire to attach to some collective group.
Yeah. I often say that I find that the only thing that the more secular side of the society understands is race, gender, and class, that those three things have replaced what are the more normal ways of identifying yourself, your family, your faith. And sometimes the locale, sometimes your country, you know, there's a kind of a patriotic, localism that people feel. But why Primal Screams? Where did those two words come out of? Because I think a lot of people recognize that there's something that's going wrong in the country, but why this almost hysteria, this high emotionalism that people seem to feel?
Well, one of the things I get into in the book that's kind of fun is a lot of new research on animal behavior. Because when we look at animals these days, we see things very differently than we used to. We understand now that animals are social learners, that they're not born knowing how to be what they are. They learn it from other animals, particularly in their families. Animal life is intensely familial. So why do I bring this up? Because we can see in experiments on animals that if they are not properly socialized, if they don't have others of their kind to learn from, then certain basic lessons that they need for survival are not there. Quick example, some cats can get out of trees if they climb up into them, and some cats can't. This is learned behavior from other animals. Hmm. My point is that humanity is in crisis because there is a dearth of people from whom to learn in this elemental way. The sexual revolution has upended the way we are meant to be. Divorce, broken homes, fatherlessness, smaller families, all of these phenomena and more that I get into in the book have reduced the number of people that we can call our own and that we can learn from. That, I think, is where the primal scream is coming from. There is a desperation under the surface of identity politics to try to recreate substitutes for these thick bonds of family that for many people aren't there anymore.
Yeah. Listen, you've raised these questions of where did this come from? And I know that in your previous books, several of which I've read myself, you've really kind of excavated some of this territory. I think that one of your books that I find to be the most striking is Adam and Eve After the Pill, what the arrival of contraceptions actually did to the relationships between men and women. And then there's that other very interesting book of yours that's sort of a takeoff on C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, if I can put it that way. It's The Loser Letters. It's about a young woman who's been caught up in the chaos of being a young woman in our society these days. How does this come about? What are the mechanisms that you've kind of uncovered in these years that you've been writing these several books that have gotten us to this point where things are so desperate that people are actually screaming out in a kind of a primal way for just something to grasp onto?
When all of this started, say in the 1960s, people might have had reason to be optimistic. I think people really didn't understand the wreckage that was straight ahead. And in the case of The Loser Letters, what I was trying to do was take issue with a very important story that we tell ourselves. By we, I mean the dominant culture, which is that religion is ebbing away because we don't need it anymore. We're too smart for that. We're too scientifically advanced for that. And I thought it would be more shocking to challenge that narrative by telling the story of an actual person. What would it be like to be a 20-something young woman with a bad romantic history who just landed in rehab? And I wanted to tell it as a story because I hoped that the shock of recognition could be there to show the dark side of a secularizing world and a world where families are broken. So in that case, I thought fiction would be more effective.
Yeah, and interestingly, that book was made into a play, wasn't it?
It was. A playwright named Jeffrey Fisk, who adapted the Screwtape Letters for stage, adapted The Loser Letters. President John Garvey at Catholic University kindly invited us to stage it and required the freshmen to see it. And it ran for 2 weeks in fall of 2016 and may run again somewhere, depending.
Yeah, someday when the virus allows us all to crawl out of our bunkers and to be out in public again.
Mm-hmm.
What is it specifically about contraception, Mary? Because you focused in on the pill in that book about Adam and Eve After the Pill. What is it about contraception in particular that you think has kind of disrupted the type of identity that people used to have in the past? And it's one of the things that is, I think, largely contributed to where we are right now.
Well, it ostensibly makes men dispensable. That's one problem. What I find so paradoxical about this, Bob, is that the effects of contraception are not well understood. But if you read deeply in the literature, if you read deeply in, for example, popular women's literature, if you look at surveys about happiness and fulfillment, you see a decline across the last 5 or 6 decades, depending on what you're looking at. And so now we've come to a point where a lot of women, especially from the tonier venues of life, decide to go it alone. I mean, the women's fashionable magazines are full of talk about freezing your eggs and having a baby when you're ready to do it and when you're financially established. And the man, again, has become dispensable. This, once more, is a way of living for which we are not adapted at all. This atomized way of living that splits apart the man and the woman is bad for us. And I think in addition to the kind of anecdotal evidence I'm mentioning, I think we also see the fallout of this in the fact that many people, especially in middle age, are getting psychiatric diagnoses. Mm-hmm. I don't know a single expert, or I haven't read a single expert, who doesn't think that the rise in psychiatric trouble over the past few decades is real. It's not just that it wasn't diagnosed before. It's rising. Something like a quarter of the women in the United States who are in middle age are on some kind of psychiatric medication.
Boy, one quarter, that's quite shocking, isn't it?
It is shocking. And so again, what I'm trying to do is illuminate a part of the fallout out there that I don't think has been adequately addressed. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, to get back to the example of other animals, if we ran the kind of experiments on other animals that we run on ourselves, catastrophe would be the result, and we would be called out for doing it. One of the reasons that there aren't elephants in circuses anymore is that scientists have showed how terribly, you know, familial and close their lives are. Baby elephants stay within 15 feet of their mothers for the first 8 years of life, for example. Wow. This is how animals are made, and if you disrupt those bonds in most species, dogs being an exception, you get some pretty catastrophic fallout. We see this very clearly when we look at other animals. This is the sort of thing that gives passion to the animal welfare movement. And yet we're going to ourselves by atomizing ourselves and treating ourselves as if we're not social creatures. And I find that juxtaposition fascinating.
Yeah, I think that there's a kind of an exaggerated Freudianism in all this, that there maybe in the Vienna of Freud, there was an overly oppressive kind of family structure. But I joke about this, but it's not all that funny, that if you think you get neurotic because your family is too close in, you should see what it's like when you don't have a family at all, when you don't get that human formation, that full human formation that we all really desperately need as beings that take a long time to mature and to actually learn about what it is that we should be doing with our lives as human beings.
To give just one pragmatic implication of this, what does it mean in a world where fewer and fewer people have brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. And fewer have a father in the house? I mean, for starters, what that means is that you have a lot of people out there with no familial experience of the opposite sex, for example. You have daughters and a mother in a home and no father, no brothers. I think this adds up to a lot of emotional illiteracy that's sort of free floating out there and that hasn't acquired a name yet. I'm trying to give it a name. Mm-hmm.
Mary, tell us a little bit about yourself. A lot of people in your books, maybe they don't know where you come from and how you got into this business. How did it all start for Mary Eberstadt?
Oh, thank you, Bob. I grew up in a series of small towns in upstate New York. Actually, most of them were hamlets. We moved about a dozen times when I was a child. My stepfather was a manual laborer, so he would move for work. I have several siblings. And when I was 16 years old, I entered an essay contest and ended up in a six-week program for high school.
I'm not surprised, by the way.
Thank you. It was at Cornell University's Telluride House, which is something that might be known to some people out there. It's a scholarship house. And the subject of the seminar was philosophy. I instantly fell in love. I ended up going to Cornell and majoring in philosophy and government. I did a double major there. And then I thought I'd go to philosophy graduate school. I took a year off just to see, because I was tired of school, frankly. And I moved to New York City and found out that people would pay me to write. And that was a very corrupting thing, because then I got off the track for graduate school and went to work for Irving Kristol at the Public Interest Magazine. And from there, I ended up connected to Jean Kirkpatrick, who was our ambassador at the United Nations, doing ghostwriting for her. And from there, I ended up in Washington, D.C., where I met my future husband. I was working as a speechwriter in the State Department at the time for George Shultz, who was our Secretary of State. And so one way and another, all of this turned out very differently from the way that I thought it would, but I've always been writing. And I know you know that feeling. Writers write, they can't help it. And I've always written in different genres, not everything is published, but that was, I think, the reason for my turn to the higher journalism instead of academia, was that there were more places to write and I could reach more people with my writing.
Yeah, well, we're glad you're not a professor at some college, and probably you would do very poorly there these days anyway. We're glad to have you in the public realm. Let's talk a bit about the future. We talked a lot about the past. We're in lockdown right now. I should say that we're recording this on May 15th, the exact middle of May, and we're hoping that in the DC area, you're in Lewes, Delaware right now, out near the coast there. But what do you see happening in the near future, quite apart from the virus problems that have arisen? If primal screams are what lots of people are feeling, and we do read about people being locked down, showing exaggerated symptoms and having to talk to psychiatrists and counselors and whatnot. But is there a way out of this cul-de-sac that we've gotten ourselves into? It's not good that we're stuck with the kinds of markers of identity. I always joke about these things, but they're not funny. But suppose we resolve the question, say, of so-called bias against homosexuals. Now that disappears. And then where is your identity then as a homosexual? Or how about a radical feminist? Suppose we get absolute equality between the sexes, as some people assume is possible. If those questions were resolved, if all class differences were resolved, if all racial differences were resolved, where then would identity be? Family clearly is always going to be there. Religion, if you're a believer, is always going to be there. A locale or a nation, we hope, is always going to be someplace where people can find a way to live together. But these other forms of identity politics and of identity, the great energies that are placed in these identity categories, they seem extremely unstable. So how long can they go on, and what could we try to do to resolve some of these problems?
So in the book Primal Screams, what I try to do is provide an answer to that of sorts. What I think needs to happen is that all of these aggrieved people, the people who make up identity politics, need to understand that a lot of people in the world are victims these days. I believe that's true, but they're not victims of what they think they're victims of. So they need to trace that victimhood back to its source, which is that the world since the sexual revolution has become a more broken place for all of us. Paradoxically, despite the internet, it's harder to make human connections. And our culture tells us this doesn't matter. It's fine to live alone. It's fine never to have a family. What the culture tells us is doing us a lot of damage. So again, I honor that feeling of victimhood because I think it's real, but I don't think it's legitimately traced to the places where people trace it now. The hope is that that shock of recognition might end up helping people get to a better place. It seems to me, Bob, we've had several wake-up calls for humanity over the last, not just the coronavirus, over the last couple of decades. In the book, writing before the pandemic, I talk about the heat wave in France. Remember that one? Mm-hmm. That killed tens of thousands of people, most of them old. And the point is, why did all those people die in one of the most advanced civilizations on Earth? The answer is that there was no one who had their back. Their families were tiny or non-existent. A lot of people were on vacation. This is a critical mass problem. All those people wouldn't have died if they had had more robust family structures to take them away from a disaster. And I think we're seeing that all over again with the pandemic. So we are creatures who can learn from experience. And one hope would be that these experiences recently, including the one we're in right now, would reaffirm for many people the importance of their relationality within the family.
Well, this is quite fascinating, Mary, and I wish we could go on and on with this, but we probably need to draw the curtain down right now. So we'll think about having you back sometime. So you've got another book on the way, don't you?
I'm working on a couple of collections right now of essays that are just floating around in cyberspace and otherwise not between covers. So there's that right now, and we'll see what comes after that.
Good. I mean, just to for the viewers, let me just to sum up again. I can't recommend to you enough Mary's most recent book, Primal Screams, but also the earlier books, Adam and Eve After the Pill. I think is a real eye opener, and I think the people who need to hear it probably aren't hearing it just yet, but someday we can hope that they do. And then, of course, The Loser Letters is really, I think, a work of genius in its imitation in a way of C.S. Lewis. So, Mary, thanks a lot. We'll hope to see you again sometime. This is Robert Royal for the Catholic Thing podcast.
Thank you, Bob.